G'day, I'm Barney Porter, and welcome to this Radio Current Affairs Summer Special. Here's a question for discussion. What's been the greatest year for music, and in particular, the rock and roll album? For the veteran British rock journalist David Hepworth, it's 1971, and he argues the case very well in his aptly named book, 1971, Never a Dull Moment. Last August, David Hepworth spoke to longtime PM presenter Mark Colvin. Enjoy.
Well, this grew from a column I wrote in the late Word magazine many years ago, and the headline of the column was 1971 was the annus mirabilis of the rock and roll album, which is something that became clear to me thanks to the internet, really. You know, it's only with the internet that, and when you've got 40, 50 years of rock and roll history, it's only with the internet that you can kind of sort it. You can see the pattern. You can look overall and you can see what the years were, and you can see what the key moments were, and you can see how releases clustered in certain years. And so I wrote this column, and unlike many columns which later on you come to recant, that one I didn't at all, you know, because everybody responded to that and said, you know, you're right, and there's this as well, and there's that as well.
Did others come back and say, no, you're quite wrong, because, you know, I turned 21 in such and such a year and that was a much better year?
Well, I still get that. I got one only yesterday, actually, saying it was 1969 or whatever. And, you know, my response to these people is always the same. It's, fine, go ahead, write your own book. But, you know, you might want to check your working out against mine, you know.
It's a good starting point, but you're slightly more dogmatic than that in the book. You say, well, you know, other people can have their years, but the big difference is that I'm right.
Well, one of us has got to be. Well, biologically, one of us has got to be, and, you know, and I would say it's me, you know, and I think the evidence is very, very strong for it being me. Point, joking aside, is that the records of 1971 still live in the present in a way that the records of 1967 or 1965 or, you know, other remarkable years, those records don't in the same way, because those records were made in a different fashion. You know, if you go back and listen to Country Joe's Electric Music for the Mind and Body, it sounds quaint now.
But if you go back one of the controversial things is that you leave out all of the Beatles by saying 71.
Well, yeah. Well, you leave them out as a unit, but you have them as individuals, because they'd officially broken up, I suppose, on New Year's Eve 1970. So you have a bit of a clean slate there. So, you know, my point was, it's the annus mirabilis of the rock album. There are more rock albums, and not just rock, I mean, take it in its broadest possible sense. There are more records from that year that we still listen to nowadays, and we don't need to make adjustments to listen to nowadays, than there are from any other year. You know, so, you know, as I always say, that if there had been a Mercury Music Prize in 1971, which is given to UK records, The shortlist would have been Rod Stewart's Every Picture Tells a Story, David Bowie's Hunky Dory, Elton John's Madman Across the Water, Paul McCartney's Ram, John Lennon's Imagine, Rolling Stone's Sticky Fingers, Who's Next, Led Zeppelin 4, and Need I Go On? You know, that's a short list, you know, because that doesn't include, I don't know, Nick Drake or all these things that were kind of culty and were not in the mainstream at all. You know, and if you want the big American albums of 1971 were Marvin Gaye's What's Going On, Sly and the Family Stones of the Right's Going On, Carole King's Tapestry, Joni Mitchell's Blue, and so on and so on. There was just an immense amount of creativity in that short period of time that still lives with us today. That's my point.
fading. Seamstress for the band. Pretty eyed pirate smile. You marry music man.
So what you say is that, to paraphrase anyway, that it was the perfect time to be alive as a music fan. I suppose the corollary of that is that, so you were born in 1950, but the people who were creating this music were mostly born during or just after the war. Is there a connection there?
I think it's interesting, that they were people. They were brought up, born during the war. Very often, the Beatles are the kind of classic case, and that they grew up during the war. That they knew bombing raids and so forth.
Mick and Keith were born under the bombing raids, under the Blitz.
Well, yeah, yes,
born
yes.
In a crossfire hurricane, as the song says.
There you go. And they grew up, they grew up during rationing and so forth, and there's very little to do, and. And they created their own amusement, And I think that's one of the things that you keep coming back to, is that in 1971, when their kind of flowering of what they'd done came out on LP for pretty much the first time, there was nothing else to do, really. I wouldn't wish a night of 1971 television on my worst enemy. I wouldn't particularly suggest anybody go and watch the movies of 1971. But the records of 1971, again, still live for us now. And they had the benefit at the time of having the kind of uninterrupted, unimpeded concentration of a huge generation of people. Because the only thing I wanted to spend money on when I was 21 was records. Simply was the only thing. You couldn't afford a car. There were obviously no phones. There was no social media. You couldn't be bothered with fashion.
Will you read us a passage about just how boring it was?
Yeah, there's a bit here. Well, I start the book with, just trying to describe what London was like in 1971. And, this bit goes as follows. Three TV channels, BBC One Saturday Night Lineup with Cliff Richard, Dixon of Dock Green, and Rolf Harris. Some shows in colour, others still in black and white. Henry Cooper advertising the great smell of brutes. Jimmy Savile promoting car seatbelts. Clunk, click, every trip. No commercial radio. Daily Mirror sells 4.5 million copies every day. Major cities have a morning and evening newspaper. No celebrity magazines. Wartime titles Revale and Titbits still popular.
When the rain came, I thought you'd leave. 'Cause I knew how much you loved the sun. But you chose to stay and keep me warm.
No mobiles, 70,000 red telephone boxes, press button B to get your money back. The only ringtone is a ringing tone. Overseas calls via the operator. Police in touch with the station via police boxes. Urgent news delivered via telegram. Train tickets checked by eye, not machine. No magnetic strips. Most people have never seen a computer in their lives. Smokers everywhere, on tube trains, in pubs, in offices, even in hospitals. No joggers, no health shops, no gyms, no leisure wear, no trainers, no mineral water, no lycra, no fast food, no obesity. Wiry people. Bieber's most popular dress sizes are 6 and 8. The only people with tattoos got them in the services. So, that's just my picture of what it was like in 1971.
When I read it, it occurred to me it's almost like reading science fiction from the other end of the telescope. It's an almost unimaginable world.
I suppose that's one of the things that I enjoyed most about writing it, actually, is that while the music from that year still means a lot to people, the world, it would just be absolutely bizarre. You know, if you dropped my children, who are in their 20s and 30s now, if you dropped them back in that world, they would be bewildered and kind of frightened, really. But that was the world that music came from. It was, you know, it was a pretty dour world, you know. I don't feel, people say to me, you wrote this book because you feel nostalgic for 1971. I don't at all. I do not wish to go back to 1971 in any shape or form. I don't particularly want to be 21 again.
But you're glad that you've got the music. Why is that music? What is it about that music that you like, if it's not nostalgia?
Well, I think you got a generation of quite exceptionally talented people giving it their best shot at the age of about 24, which is what most of them were. They'd been on the road through the 60s and the early 70s, so they were quite well schooled. You know, they were quite professional, but they suddenly got an opportunity to go in the studio and write and record pretty much anything you want to do, provided you do it in 2 weeks. You know, you can't indulge yourself. You can't go away to an island and think beautiful thoughts for ages and then spend months remixing it. You've just got to do it and do it quickly, and we'll put it out quickly, and you'll have the benefit of it being presented to a very receptive audience of young people who will really listen to it and really respond to it.
Spend it all, the have nots. Money, we make it. Before we see it, you take it.
And I think that's what happened. And I think at the same time, the technology of recording was just sophisticated enough, but not too sophisticated. It very quickly after that got too sophisticated. It got 16 track and 32 track and so forth. I don't want to get technical here, but you know what it's like in the world of audio.
Sure.
You know, the more time and technology you've got, the more time you spend second guessing yourself. We can always do it again. We can polish it a bit. Whereas the beauty of doing things quickly is very often your first thought is your best thought. And so if you look at loads of those records, you know, you look at David Bowie's 1971, he released Man Who Sold the World. He recorded and released Hunky Dory, and he recorded all but one track of Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars in the calendar year 1971. Nobody does that anymore.
But what is it that changes? Let's start with Bowie then. What is it that changes Bowie from somebody who had only a few years ago had a song called The Laughing Gnome and was mainly known for Space Oddity? What turns him into the person who produces Ziggy or the masterpiece that is Hunky Dory?
Well, he goes to America in February 1971. He manages to blag a trip to America, which for anybody in Britain in those days was just a dream come true, the idea of being able to go to America.
This is another thing that people don't understand is that international travel was so rare by comparison.
So rare. It's absolutely so rare. The only people who've been overseas are people who've been sent in the army. It'd been fairly unpleasant, you know. But and so David Bowie goes to the States, and he pretty much sleeps on people's sofas, and he has a lot of fans in the record company, and they take him round, and he goes all over the country, and he sees the Stooges, and he sees the Velvet Underground. He has that, you know, that sudden exposure to a very different culture. And he's immensely excited by the fact that you've suddenly got millions of radio stations and you can get loads of records at Tower Records and you know, the Great Plenty, which was the thing that always struck you when you went from Britain to the United States in the 70s, is comparative plenty. And so he has that kind of great epiphany, you know, during that period. And he comes away with the idea for Ziggy Stardust. He's already, well, he offers one of the songs, Hang On To Yourself, I think, to Gene Vincent, who is staying in the same house he's staying in.
Talk about intergenerational change.
Yeah, but also, you see, don't forget, there wasn't that much age difference between Gene Vincent and David Bowie. There's only a few years. You know, we tend to think of these things, we tend to think the greasers belonged in one world and the hippies belonged in another world. Well, that's not necessarily the case, you know. One of the points I tried to make is that this generation of rock and rollers who did this great stuff in the in 1971 were, as I say, 24, 25, 26 years old. Some of them as old, some of them as old as 30. And they remembered rock and roll. They remembered the beginning. They remembered a time when there'd not been any rock and roll, which is something, it's unimaginable to us now, you know.
I could have loved you, girl, like a planet. I could have changed your heart to a star.
That was looking back, but they also weren't really looking forward to the idea that this stuff was going to be classic, that we would be, you and I would be talking about it in 45 years' time.
There was no indication whatsoever that anybody even had a glimmer of an idea that that would happen.
It was still a throwaway culture.
It was, you know, bands were, they went on stage and they played their new songs. That's what they did. But the difference was their new songs were really good.
So what?
So Led Zeppelin are touring in 1971 and they're doing Stairway to Heaven and, you know, rock and roll and all these things. But record hasn't come out, won't come out for another 6 months, you know.
That brings me on to the question of what is the difference, because you make this distinction, between pop, which you say is 60s, and then 71, you're calling it rock.
Well, I can go either way on this argument. You know, I think all good stuff is pop music. You know what I mean? But I suppose the division really with rock was that the medium is the 12-inch album. You know, and it's the 35 to 40 minute listening experience. It tends to be more aimed at men than women. As pop had always been traditionally aimed at women, at young girls, and it's been about 3 minute singles on 7-inch 45s. You know, these things have their eras. You know,
so why does the album era sort of begin at the beginning of the '70s? I mean, there'd been the Beatles albums and the Stones albums. There'd been exceptions in the '60s, but why does radio become so obsessed with the album? Why do people start buying albums in larger numbers?
I think there's lots of things, different things in different territories. If you look in the United States, you got the sudden popularity of FM radio, which realized that you could program albums pretty much as you used to program singles, quite scientifically, with them coming round quite frequently, and you know, that's what made records like Carole King's Tapestry really, 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 really big. I remember from my point of view about the album, and at the time in Britain, it was £2.15 or something like that to buy an album. So it was a luxury, but it was an affordable luxury. You couldn't buy one every week, but, you know, if you had a job, you might buy one every third week or something like that.
But then around that time, people started having stereos in their student rooms or whatever. Was that a big
absolutely a big
change?
Thing? And that was what they, you know, in the days, what they called the music center, you know. And stereo, don't forget, was a kind of miracle in itself, you know. And so you suddenly had to have a stereo. Here's the point: if you were setting up a house, young people, you were setting up a home, a flat or a house or whatever. In Britain in 1971, the first item you set up was the record player. It wasn't the first thing. You got the kettle and the record player, and you could carry on living once you did that.
But when you look at the television ratings, people were watching, you know, 10 or 12 million people might watch the two Ronnies or something like that in an evening.
But not young people. Ah. Probably not young people. They, you know, they were, you know, quite sensibly, you know, carrying on, you know, drinking, having sex and listening to rock and roll. You know, they didn't need screen entertainment at that point. That came later on. But, you know, the record player was, I can remember flats, you know, which had no curtains and no running water. But the record player was in there and was working and would have around it clustered the combined record collections of all the people in the house, which even in those days, that was, if you had 60 records, you had a lot of records.
Who's the black private dick that's a sex machine to all the chicks? You're damn right.
Carole King represented a huge change for women. Bowie, I think, represented a great change in attitudes towards sexuality overall. What about black/white relations and what happens in black music in 1971?
Well, you've got huge breakthroughs in black music. It's the year of Al Green comes through, you know, I Can't Get Next to You. It's the year of Isaac Hayes and the soundtrack from Shaft. So it's got the beginnings of what we later came to call blaxploitation. You've got all sorts of things going on around Curtis Mayfield. But the two big thing, I suppose, are Marvin Gaye's What's Going On, which he initially put out as a single. And nobody believed in it at all. And he probably didn't believe in it either. But it was a huge hit. And very quickly, Berry Gordy turned around and said, well, where's the album? And they had to do the album in a tearing hurry. But the one record that fascinates me more than any, actually, is, this was the big album of in America in Christmas 1971. It was the big seller. the biggest of all big sellers. Was Sly and the Family Stones, There's a Riot Going On. Now, if anybody hasn't heard it, go home tonight and play Sly and the Family Stones, There's a Riot Going On. It's the weirdest, most out there, strangest record you will ever hear in your life.
It's an utter explosion of energy, for
if
one
you
thing.
Put it out, if you put it out tomorrow, people go, what's this? This is bizarre. You know, it's kind of, it's so, you know, so thick. You know, it's kind of, he's recorded track over track over track. The loudest sound on it is the tape hiss. And it's utterly impenetrable, apart from the fact he's got this one song, Family Affair, which is just a brilliant record. One of the two records in 1971 that uses an automated rhythm track, which is, of course, became the wave of the future. But I do think that says a lot to me about 1971, that the biggest album in America in Christmas of that year was that weird record. It wasn't poked away on a kind of disco chart or an indie chart or a challenging black music chart. It was in the mainstream, because there was one mainstream in 1971 and everybody was in there. Led Zeppelin, Nick Drake, Rod Stewart, the former Beatles, the Rolling Stones, everybody was in there giving it the best shot. And I think ultimately that's why it was such an impressive year.
Born with the moon in Cancer, choose her a name she will answer to.
Little Green by Joni Mitchell, ending Mark Colvin's interview with the veteran British rock journalist David Hepworth, whose book, 1971, Never a Dull Moment, no doubt has started many a debate. And a special thanks to Alan Arthur, who I can reveal really enjoyed putting that package together, having begun his album collection in, yes, 1971. And that's all in this Radio Current Affairs Summer Special. I'm Barney Porter. Thanks for your company.
Just a little green, like the nights when the northern lights perform. There'll be icicles and birthday clothes, and sometimes there'll be snow.